Welcome to the Bread and Roses Show here on WXOJ 103.3 FM Valley Free Radio, streaming at valleyfreeradio.org. I'm Joel Sachs. On the Bread and Roses Show, we talk about a range of issues related to creating a fair economy and social justice. In the background is Mr. Lester Young. As you may know, the term Bread and Roses comes in part from that great strike in Lawrence, Mass., just an hour or so east of here. Started in the Everett Mill, 1912. It's 101 years ago. In the bitter of winter, some 20,000 women and children, and men as well, went out on strike. They came together across ethnic, linguistic lines, and for 6 weeks they fought the bosses. They fought the National Guard. The Army came in, and through locking arms, through solidarity, they won, and it became the first great industrial strike that won in this country, led by the Wobblies, industrial workers of the world, one union of all workers, and was a beacon for the labor movement at that point. It showed what it meant for workers to come together for demands for better wages and working conditions. So that's where we draw our name. And on today's show, we have Allison Butler, a scholar of media studies, media literacy, a professor in the Department of Communication at UMass. And it's so interesting to think about in our time with the changes that have gone on and the way in which corporations, that ever smaller number of corporations, has taken over the media landscape, this oligopoly of about five multinational corporations that control so much of what we see, we hear, we read, so-called information, that while Marx theorized that production, the struggle in the workplace, was central, the class struggle, so to speak, what we could say now, what theorists, I think, I'm not sure what Allison would say, but certainly that there has been this shift, and so the struggle around representation of who owns and controls the media, what stories get told, becomes as critical as production. So we go from production to representation, who controls the means of representation, so to speak. And that's what we'll be talking about today. So welcome, Allison.
Thank you very much.
Welcome to the Bread and Roses Show. Since we're talking about media literacy, I thought the first thing that might be good, I realize I didn't ask you this on the pre-questions, the list I sent to you, but it's the most obvious question, is tell us a little bit about, for people who don't know that term media literacy, how you define that.
Well, I certainly don't define it on my own. I have a long history of amazing teachers and work that has been done in the United States, work that I'm most familiar with in the Northeast, and a lot of work done in the United Kingdom, particularly in London. So I'm going to borrow from all of my amazing teachers' definitions. First and foremost, media literacy is critical thinking. It's critical inquiry. It's asking questions. And it's providing young people and adults with the ability to analyze the media, the ubiquitous media, the media that are all around us. Personally, I come from a cultural studies background. And so my understanding and my definition of media are broad, varied. Most obviously would be electronic media, television, radio, film, certainly the internet. But it's also, we can't forget the important non-electronic media, our books, our magazines, our newspapers. These days we have to pay special attention to media that cut across technologies, increasing digital media, social networking. It's also who we are as bodies, our own cultural texts, our positions in gender, race, social class, perceived ability, perceived disability. So there's such a broad range of issues. And what we're looking to do within media literacy is to analyze, to ask questions, in some cases, we're also looking to be able to produce media that, particularly for young people, beyond analysis, that ability to produce, to make their own media, low-tech, high-tech, collages, videos, helps engage them further in the process, engage them further in the experience. It is constantly, consistently asking questions so that we can learn more about what surrounds our daily lives, what is part of our daily life.
So I know you're, I mean, I know you, you're, we share, we both have adjoining cubes in Montmore at the Department of Communication. So we're kind of office mates, and can overhear each other and the walls that only go so high. So I hear a little bit about your teaching. You work hard as a lecturer, and so there's a whole question of how does media literacy fit in the college classroom. But I wanted to ask you more in terms of you also wear a hat as doing media curriculum development and teaching here in with younger people, with high school, mm-hmm. middle-aged students or middle school students. So tell us a little bit about what media literacy with a K through 12 or media middle high school students might look like. What are some of the kinds of projects, curriculum that they might engage?
Oh, there's so many. Some of my favorites that I've done with college students and with high school students and with middle school students include one of my top favorites is actually to play around with what advertising is. We seem to be so surrounded by advertising, and so playing around with what advertising is. And I borrow some of these questions directly from Gloria Steinem's work when she was starting Ms. Magazine, and her conundrum with complimentary copy, with the way in which advertisements that are obvious are very clear to us, but how does a more subtle language work its way into what we think are articles in magazines. And she was particularly concerned with the way in which women's cosmetics worked products into articles. And so an activity that I've done with middle school students, I changed the magazines depending on the age group, but with middle school students, high school students, and college students, is we take mass market, generally speaking, women's magazines, Cosmopolitan, Vogue, Elle, Harper's Bazaar.
17
I've done with high school students. J14 I've done with middle school students, Tiger Beat. And we begin by looking through the magazines and just seeing what's there. And sometimes that close looking gets students to realize some of the very boundaried constructions over what women's beauty is. Inevitably, students walk away from that first part of the assignment saying, wow, everybody in here is white. All these women in here, they're so skinny. Or even the women who look like they might be of color are really light-skinned. Sometimes there are celebrities that they say, she looks like they made her skin lighter. And so it begins a fantastically rich conversation, both on gender and on ethnicity. And then the second part of this is they rip out all the advertisements. And that's really fun. It's fun because it's tactile. It's tangible. You get to play around with this. It involves the students in the activity.
They rip out all the
ads? Sort
or
of.
Select.
That's the thing is I say to them, rip out the advertisements. And they say, well, what do you mean by advertisements? And I say, well, what do you mean by advertisements? So they rip everything that they think is an advertisement out. And then we're left with just a few pieces of paper. And we play around because sometimes there might be a full page ad on one side, an article on another. So we're flexible with this. And then we look through what's left. And unfortunately, I can't do the visual on radio, but almost inevitably what happens is they'll hold up just that binder, that little bit of paper that holds it together, and they'll say, this is it. Because once we start going through the editorial copy, we see the quantity of brands that are mentioned. We see some celebrity talking about a new film or a new television show. We see the way in which there's a sort of very careful construction to the writing, particularly, Vice columns are fantastic for this, where they're recommending particular brands as problem solvers. And the students say, this is all advertisements. This is what, and there's this pause. There's this moment where there's this aha of everything that they're reading is actually either obviously or subtly an advertisement. But then the third part of this, and this is one of the things that I think is so important about media literacy, is the students say, I get this mostly with my university students, sometimes with high school students as well, less so with middle school students, is but I still want to read this. I like to read this when I'm in the airport. I like to read this on my day off. I still enjoy this. And so we get to play around with that idea of fan culture. How can we still get, if we choose to, enjoyment or pleasure from something, from that ability to, because sometimes it's the act of, it's not necessarily what's in the magazine. It's that act of sitting back with a coffee or a tea, sitting in an airport where, you know, I mean, spending time in airports isn't all that great. How can we escape from being in the airport? Taking time away from our busy schedule to be in this totally, you know, sort of self-absorbed space. How can we get enjoyment and still be critical? And that's one of the things that I value about media literacy, at least the media literacy that I try and work with, is that notion that we can be fans, we can find enjoyment, and we can be critical. One of the first things that I try and teach my students is that critical doesn't equal negative. Critical doesn't equal dislike. To be critical is to take a space away, to take some distance, and to look at a text, whatever that text might be, trying to look at it from this multi-perspectival position. How can I acknowledge the forces of production and know that this is from a mainstream media outlet whose goal is profit and still find enjoyment? And so that's one of my favorite exercises to do with students, because I think it captures so much of what we're looking for. We get to talk about mainstream media. We get to talk about advertising. We get to talk about race and gender and class. Certainly one of the things that gets analyzed when we're tearing out the adverts is how much stuff costs. So who's expected to purchase this? We get to talk about ease of access. Where are these magazines? We don't have to hunt them down. They're right there in the supermarket aisle or the pharmacy aisle or on the street. You know, those of us, when I lived in New York, you could just, you know, pluck them from the newsstand on every corner. And we can enjoy them. And how can we put all of those pieces together? And that's one of the things that I just, this is, you know, what gets me out of bed in the morning, is that ability to practice this critical work and find enjoyment from it and learn all of this material. And I learn so much from my students. I mean, I have the media that I engage in, but my students also provide me with so much more than I knew about. And that's one of the things that's also really valuable, I find, about middle school, high school, and college students, is how much they know. And that's another one of these things that I just, there's so many things that I think are valuable about media literacy. I could go on for days. But it's also that ability to share information and to undo hierarchies. I'm not the expert teacher voice, that's it, my story only. It's that ability to share knowledge, to own our knowledge.
It's wonderful to hear you talk about it. One of the things, when you describe the act of tearing out the magazine, I think just the performative, the dramatic, symbolic action of what that does in a young person's experience, to actually be ripping it apart, just that action alone is just very powerful.
It is, because
you're ripping the whole thing. I mean, literally, but also symbolically, you're saying, "Wait a minute,
absolutely,
what's here? I'm just going to rip this apart."
Yeah, and this is changing. I mean, this is changing to some degree these days with social networking and with digital media, that young people do have a little bit more opportunity. I want to be very cautious about how I say this. They do have a little bit more opportunity to be involved in some degree of media production. And yet when we start to take apart the layers of social networking and digital media, certainly digital distribution, is we can still see that conglomerate, that corporate element is still very strong. But really, up until a few years ago, we were very separated from media production. Media came to us. Television came to us in our homes. Films, we would go to the cinema. Magazines came to us fully made. Newspapers, etc. And that's where production becomes so valuable, because it invites us in to that process of actual construction. Or I suppose, if we're tearing stuff out, deconstruction, like the physical act of it. And I think there is a certain psychological benefit to this, or sort of social benefit to this, in this is a time where we realized how distanced we are from the production of our mass media, how many decisions are made before it even comes to us. And we are trained to accept what comes to us in our homes, and there's an alienation from its production. And again, I do think this is changing a little bit today in the way in which social networking and digital media, but there's the illusion is still there. That illusion is still there of choice and enjoyment and pleasure in terms of the forces of production.
We're here on the Bread and Roses show with Professor Allison Butler, a scholar of media studies, particularly media literacy. And this is the Bread and Roses show. And if you're interested in participating in the conversation here, you want to call in. The number here is 413-585-1033. 585-1033. You can remember it because those last four numbers are the same numbers as the call numbers for our studio, WXOJ 103.3 FM, Valley Free Radio. If you want to call in, 413-585-1033. One question, I mean many questions, but one question that I've wrestled with in teaching this kind of material is also the issue of political economy and the underlying structures. So when we talk about the fashion industry and magazines, are there exercises you do, ways that you also have them then look at what are the economics underlying those multinational corporations that own those fashion magazines and own the TV stations and own the publishing companies, et cetera, et cetera? Have you done those kinds of exercises as well, or can think about pedagogy? Because that's one of the challenges, I think, is both looking at text, analyzing the text, and then the context, text and context. So that's a challenge for me. We're all getting, for example, Comcast.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's now bought NBC. All of its money is our money, and something that I come back to is just where do they get that money?
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's all our money.
Mm-hmm.
That's where it comes from. And why should this not be a public utility? The biggest cash cow, one of the biggest things is these bills, $100 or more for a cable that runs into your house, right? It's 2/3 of the state of Massachusetts is Comcast. It's over, it was a third. It's larger than that now, right? What Comcast controls. And so we get this huge array of dreck, of pablum, of banal, by and large, unless you get premium and you've got HBO and you can see something like HBO Girls or Treme or whatever. But by and large, most of what we get is the same old in terms of corporate media. So the promise of cable in the 70s of what it was supposed to offer and how it's just become one more complete corporate surfeit nothingness, right? And so that larger question of structure and structural change, is that something that what you see in the media literacy movement, is that also something that gets wrestled with?
I do think it's something that gets wrestled with. I think that...
It's so large, so
it's
easier to deal with the immediate text in some ways.
It's easier to deal with the immediate text, but you can never take the text out of its context. I think that political economy needs to be a much stronger part of American media literacy. I think political economy needs to be a much larger part of the American conversation. I think as Americans, we're pretty bad at talking about political economy. In large part because I think we have, certainly in a middle to upper class environment, have had the luxury of not talking about it. But it's a false luxury. And I think there is the temptation, and I've certainly fallen for it myself, to stay focused on representation, because representation is juicy. And students can talk about representation for a long time, and they get really invested in representation, as well they should. It's a fantastic entry point. But we need to talk about what's behind that representation. We need to talk about those forces of production. And it's really hard to talk about because it's very hard to illustrate. It's hard to see it. I mean, the idea that Comcast is in 2/3 of the state, where do we locate that tangibly, right? How do we look at that in a classroom space? The idea that it's owned by NBC, like, what does that mean? I know what it means.
Well, not own that Comcast now owns NBC.
Right. Excuse me. That Comcast owns NBC, right. But where is that? I mean, we don't have a place in our community where NBC is, right? I mean, it's such an ideological thing. And so when I try and bring it up in the classroom...
Yeah, and this is the challenge of at the Everett Mill in Lawrence, you know, in Flint, Michigan, the owner who owned the factory and who was in charge was very clear. Because
right.
they were oppressing you every day.
Right.
You saw it immediately.
Absolutely.
Right. These things are in outer space. You know, they're in a cloud somewhere, and they come to us through this cable, but we have absolutely no direct contact with whoever is pushing the buttons and pulling all the profits.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And there is no material place for us to go to say, I like this or I dislike this, or this is working for me or this isn't working for me, or I want something different. Like, we don't have that tangible relationship. You know, I mean, one of the things that's so effective about Marx looking at the factory is exactly what you're saying. I mean, we see the manager, right? We see the factory boss. We see the factory floor. We see the work being done. We see the work, the product leaving the factory. We don't see that these days with our mass media. And it's all so, it's so very convenient to us when it comes into our homes. That check that we write or the online banking that we do every month doesn't seem materially connected. It's extraordinarily material, but it doesn't seem material connected to sitting down on the couch and watching a movie that comes to us in our television. So the way in which I try and deal with it in the classroom is to do that text context, to constantly kind of do the text context, but also to try and play around with what we expect and what might be beyond our expectations. So I always ask, you know, particularly of my university students, if any of them have a job. So many of them raise their hands. And I ask how many of them get paid to go to that job, and they raise their hands. And I ask how many of you would be willing at the end of your two-week pay cycle to go to your boss or your HR director and say, no thanks, I don't need my money this week. And they all start laughing. I said, but that's one of the things that we're doing right now. Like, when we put stuff on Facebook or Twitter or Instagram, when we upload videos on YouTube, we're laboring. We're doing work for free. And then I ask, how many of you would be willing at the end of your pay period to go to your human resources director and say, not only do I not want to get paid, but I'm going to give you money. All the money that I earned, you know, all my hourly wage or my salary for this past 2 weeks, I don't need it, I don't want it, and I'm going to just give it to you. Here's the cash value of it. And they all laugh. Of course nobody's going to do this. But I'm like, that's one of the things that we are doing by paying our cable bill, for example. Facebook tells us on its opening page, free and always will be.
So, right, that's the response students will say. Well, wait a minute, we're getting this free network that we don't have to pay for.
But they are paying for it. They're not paying for Facebook. It's not like they're writing a check to Facebook every month. But the only way to get Facebook is to have some version of cable, something like that. It's DSL, satellite, something on their phone. They have to have a smartphone. Like, they're paying for it somewhere. But it's so disconnected from that posting what you're up to at this moment, or posting a picture on Instagram, or putting up a funny video on YouTube. And we're caught up in it. I mean, you know, sometimes students sort of fight back and they're like, well, do you just not have a cell phone? I'm like, no, I do. I have a smartphone. I get it. I'm part of it too, because this is the way that we're communicating these days. And, you know, my second book was using Facebook to gather data. Like, how can we make sense of this as these forces of production and this connection of where our money is going and how we are spending our money? Sometimes what I'll do is take a particular product or maybe a particular film. Harry Potter's a perfect example. It's a book, it's a film, it's an amusement park, it's, you know, a travel destination, it's candy, it's bed sheets, it's Halloween costumes, it's lunch boxes. It's so many different things.
The franchise.
The franchise, exactly. The brand of Harry Potter. And we say, how do we, you know, who owns this and where is it coming from and how do we trace its story? And so it's a lot about what I try and do is say, you know, how do we trace where this is? How do we follow this one thing up its ladder of ownership, up the ladder of abstraction, and make sense of where it goes? And that sometimes when we're dealing with what appear to be competing industries, ooh, who's going to get my attention today? If we climb that ladder, it's in the same spot. It's in the exact same spot. We make a choice to watch one television show or another. And if we climb the ladder, they're owned by the same corporation.
It's wonderful to hear you talk, and it just stirs a lot up. I think about how, I guess it was two summers ago, that Apple stocks became more profitable than ExxonMobil as another one of those signifiers of how the economy has changed in terms of what's most prominent, from production to representation, to information. And then with the IPO of Facebook and Zuckerberg becoming one of the most... One of the richest people in the world, right? From, as you say, our labor,
mm-hmm.
right? And yet, it makes me think, as we share space in the Department of Communication, that there really isn't much of a at least I don't know about it. Maybe I need to go online and do more searching. But this kind of union of critical users, consumers. That are saying, wait a minute, how do we, as kind of in a wobbly sense, in a union of all workers or all consumers or all, you know, users of these things, how do we come back together and fight back? And Adbusters is certainly one group, mm-hmm. whether it was calling for the occupation of Zuccotti Park or has issued those kinds of general principled demands and visions. But is there anything going on like that within the world of media literacy where there's a larger political consciousness about the need to really push back and even say this should be ours, this should be a public utility? Why is Facebook private? This is all our information. As you say, we're paying for the portals. We pay for to get that information. So why don't we own it as a socialist? You know, that right. perspective. Does that ever in the circles of media literacy, or is that just too radical?
Oh,
or is it?
Wow.
I mean, it's the question of how deep anti-communism is ingrained, and our complete inability in this country generally to have a larger conversation about what an alternative vista would look like, what
Absolutely.
An alternative cultural economy might be.
It's so hard to have that alternative conversation, and I put myself in that position too. I mean, I think
It's not supported. I mean,
yeah.
In our department, that conversation doesn't exist. You know, as radical as people may be, you know, where do we hear it within? It's the way hegemony even works within our critical academic circles.
Right. I mean, and this is one of the things that Gramsci said, was that hegemony is going to work because it's consent. We consent to it on a daily basis. In part, I mean, in some parts of it, we consent because we haven't been educated otherwise. But it's the radical change would have to happen in a oh my goodness. I mean, as I'm thinking about it, I'm stumbling over my words because I keep taking my thoughts further and further. In terms of media, let's see if I can break this down a little bit. In terms of media literacy, one of the things that media literacy does now, broad brushstrokes that media literacy does now, is takes on that critical approach of mainstream media, critical assessment of mainstream media. I think there are certainly a lot of folks out there working to change the media system. There's no doubt about it. But we also have to begin with knowing what our media system is. And unfortunately, I don't think we know what our media system is that clearly. We need a much clearer education on what our media system is, particularly that line between entertainment, enjoyment, and profit. And what bring, you know, what comes to us as entertaining is also very profitable for somebody else and for some other corporation, not necessarily ourselves. I think change happens through, I mean, certainly the motivation for this show, we see that change happens through grassroots efforts. It's devoted, dedicated people working together collaboratively to make change. And that's going to start off happening in small pockets. Our media system in the United States is not the only media system in the world, although it is probably the strongest media system in the world. The United States is the largest exporter of media, and yet we do not educate our youth in any capacity. To the degree that we export our media, we are not educating our young people about what our media are about, how our media are organized.
You write a little bit about the UK and the media literacy system there. Can you say just a little bit?
David Buckingham is a scholar from the UK. He's out of London, and he was one of my teachers, and he has had a real influence on my theoretical and practical understanding. And one of the things that he writes about is that countries other than the United States, the UK, Canada, Australia, are the three strongest examples, began their media literacy training much earlier than the US, in part because so much of their media was imported from the US. Mm-hmm. And they were working in a place of saying, what is this American culture that's coming to us uncritiqued? How do we work with this, right? Now, we're also dealing with very different school systems and very different ways of bringing this into the classroom. So we can't make a direct parallel example.
But that's important, just the distinction you make in mm-hmm. that they have national systems.
They have national systems,
whereas
national education
we
systems.
It's all broken up.
Right. The United States education system is, you know, what have we got, 65 million square miles, state-based systems, sometimes, you know, multiple systems within a state. Our geography is so, I mean, we are such a huge geographic space that a national school system is certainly beyond the media literacy conversation. Certainly with the UK, we're dealing with a slightly smaller population. One example that I like to give my students all the time is to try and make sense of the kind of massive land that we're dealing with is the island of Manhattan itself. Teeny, teeny, tiny island of Manhattan has 8 million people, Monday through Friday, 9 to 5. The country of Denmark has 8 million people. So when my students are like, oh, well, what about, you know, a national education system? It's look at what's going on. This is a very small body of land. Has the same population as an entire country. So we're dealing with these scales here that need it's hard to wrap one's mind around the scale of what we're dealing with here. Personally, do I think that there needs to be radical change? Sure. I'm not sure if I'm the one to do that, but I think that radical change has to start in it's that small group of grassroots dedicated individuals. And my portion would be to work with media literacy.
So let's talk about that. Let me just say we're here on the Bread and Roses Show, WXOJ 103.3 FM Valley Free Radio, streaming at valleyfreeradio.org. We're here with Allison Butler, a scholar of media studies and media literacy who teaches in the Department of Communication at UMass. I'm Joel Sachs. And Allison, you're also a leader. I mean, talking about, you know, what your particular part of that small committed group of activists is of a statewide media literacy consortium. And tell us a little bit about what that is and what projects are underway right now.
Sure. I'm part of the steering committee of the Massachusetts Media Literacy Consortium. And the work that we are doing now is to develop legislation to include media literacy in the K-12 public school curriculum. The legislative aspect of this is to say that this is material that needs to be included in the classroom. One of the things that we're hoping to do is include it across the curriculum. So we have the study of the media and the concepts of media literacy included in a variety of classes, that these aren't going to be separate classes. The motivation behind that not being separate classes is sometimes media literacy is offered as an elective. It's offered as if you've finished your requirements, you can take this fun media class. And our argument is to say that this is something that should be included in all classes. Another area of our work is actually in curriculum development. And that's something that I'm involved in on a day-to-day basis with this group and with my UMass students is developing media literacy curriculum. So, for example, I have my students right now in my media literacy class are developing two units per grade, and they're picking different classes. And ultimately, we'd like to have two units per course per grade. And the way that we're dividing it up in our group is analysis as one unit and production as another unit. And so that we would like to have a breadth of curriculum available and then opportunities to train teachers so in media literacy and then to make these units work in their courses, to have it blend in the classes that they're teaching. So those are our sort of two big areas with MMLC.
So wait, let me get this straight. That's very exciting. So first of all, your media literacy class, how many students generally?
This class is 25.
So they break up and they're working on developing units. So, for example, they would develop a unit for a math class?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yep. I just had a meeting this afternoon with a student whose group is working on developing units for a science class. And some of the ideas that they're tossing out have stuff to do with, say, forensics, for example, comparing what is learned scientifically and how we learn about it, say, in CSI, or our connections to health. Certainly with pharmaceutical advertising, we have become our own medical experts, even without medical degrees. What do we learn about health and wellness through the media, and how can that be brought into, say, a biology class? Some of their other ideas have to do with genetics and then the way in which genetics play out in our physical bodies and our connection with the media. I mean, so much of what us, you know, average everyday individuals learn about science and scientific development is through the media. What are we learning? How can we bring that into the classroom to provide students with these critical questions to learn, to take their learning further, and have it be beyond what is presented in that representation?
That's such a wonderful project. So the outcome will be, is this material posted online? I mean, obviously there's got to be some review of it. It's students' work. But
yeah,
still, I mean, I found undergraduates can do pretty damn good work.
Are you kidding? They're awesome.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Huge shout out to my spring 2013 media literacy class. They are amazing. They are living and breathing media literacy. I'm not sure if they know it yet, but they are absolutely living and breathing it. One of the tenets of media literacy is that it undoes the hierarchy of the classroom. And my students are bringing me stuff every day, material, texts, music, musical artists, a lot to do with social networking and digital media. And I have learned such an incredible amount from them. They have access and they have enjoyment from stuff that is sort of beyond my wheelhouse, but oh my goodness, learning it from them is phenomenal. Back to the curriculum project, the goal is that by the end of the term, we will have from my students and our work together a series of projects, I guess we could call them, that could be integrated into classrooms.
Lesson plans,
exactly. Yeah. And we're looking to pilot them and practice them at the end of this school year from late May to June, probably with teachers who are our friends and who are supporters, because they're going to be rough drafts, no doubt. And then aiming to pilot them on a much larger scale starting in the fall with proper teacher training. I mean, one of the things that I learned the hard way was when I was working in a public school in New York City developing media literacy curriculum was, you know, all these fantastic ideas, you can't just drop them in a classroom. I mean, I feel so naive when I say it now, like, oh yeah, we had these great ideas to bring to classrooms. And looking back on it, it was so terribly naive of me, because teachers deserve to be trained in this as well, right? I mean, if we talk about how our students aren't getting critical media literacy, well, neither are our teachers. You know, our teachers are not being trained to teach critical media literacy. So part of our work with this curriculum project is also to provide teachers with professional development so that this can be part of, not separate from, the courses that they are teaching.
So I want to go to a challenge that we've talked a little bit about, not on the show right now, but that obstacle, it's something in my own media literacy work in public schools I've seen of the testing.
Mm-hmm.
This neoliberal mm-hmm. regime that's mm-hmm. been imposed, this productivity regime that ultimately Bill Gates sits at the top of as the largest funder. It's so useful for everybody out there to know that the biggest voice, the biggest hammer behind school reform in this country is Mr. Bill Gates, who has funded more of the so-called reform efforts around the country than anybody else. So it's not democracy, it's not everyday people, it's not even the politicians that are making the decisions right now about so-called reform, quote-unquote reform, which is essentially the privatization, the corporatization, the computerization, the testing, the tailorization, the assembly line, mm-hmm. factory-like. We're producing output. We're you know, nature of education. So that squeeze,
yes,
that every public school teacher I know doesn't just bemoan. I mean, they're bludgeoned by it. Has, in my experience, been the force that causes teachers to say, "I'd really like to do this, but there is a test. There is just a Holyoke Public School is an example. They were, I don't know if it's still the case, but there was something called America Reads that was the uniform computer-based curriculum that every school teacher had to follow. The Holyoke Public School bought this, and that's what drove their curriculum. And I was part of an after-school program doing video media literacy, media arts in the after-school at the Kelly School in the Flats. And I wanted to try to connect what we were doing after school with the readings they were doing and or whatever. How could we do video at after school that would somehow complement what was going on during the day? And the teachers I spoke with were very interested, but the bottom line they said is there's a clock here, there's a test coming up, and we can't do it. So that pressure, how and that's that squeeze, and then the financial cutbacks, those forces, how can you bring something new to teachers who are already feeling incredibly squeezed?
Oh, I think squeezed is the exact right word, and teachers are so. They're dedicated to their classes. There's no doubt about it, and they are feeling bludgeoned, to use your words. And so, how do we bring something new? Well, carefully. And one of the things that I believe in that media literacy can do is it can provide, particularly for students who are struggling with some of the traditional ways of learning, struggling with traditional literacy, struggling with testing. One of the things that media literacy can provide is it helps make the unfamiliar familiar. If you provide a young person with the opportunity to make sense of and to analyze something that they are familiar with, to ask questions of something that they are familiar with, can that learning, can that questioning, can that critical inquiry translate to the unfamiliar? So can we build a certain degree of confidence that says, okay, I can take apart this song that I like, or I can analyze this show that I like, and can we use those skills and have them apply to what is unfamiliar? Testing is unfamiliar. Testing is scary. I have a PhD and I'm a horrible test taker. They make me nervous. What can we do to apply what makes us feel strong and confident and intellectually available and intellectually ready? Can we use media literacy to help that squeeze? There's a great program at Amherst Cinema that it's another one of the things that my students work on, which teaches visual literacy to third graders. And these are primarily third graders from Holyoke, from Chicopee, from Springfield, who are certainly struggling with traditional expected learning models. These are kids that by third grade have kind of come to agree with the fact or accept the fact that they are stupid, even though they are absolutely not stupid. But they might have language learning problems or literacy problems. They come to Amherst Cinema. They engage in watching films and creating stories about these films. They practice storyboarding. They practice group poetry, verbal. I mean, they don't have to. They can write it down, but they don't have to write it down. So there's not necessarily the pressure of not knowing how to spell certain words. They practice internal dialogue versus what we say out loud. Those skills provide these students with a new story about who they are, a story about who they are as competent, as confident, as smart, as capable. Can that process of saying, how do we make a story? How do we write? Maybe we write visually for a little bit to learn how to write through, traditional words. I think that what media literacy can do with the proper training for teachers, with the proper professional development for teachers, not leaving them out on a limb, here's something else for you to do, but to provide them with that ability to say, we can bring the familiar to the unfamiliar, and we can write a new story for these students and how they perceive their own intellectual abilities and how they perceive their ability to ask and answer questions. And for that student that might feel left out because of his or her skin color or his or her sexual identity or his or her perceived socioeconomic status or his or her perceived physical abilities or disabilities, to provide them that ability to say, this is what the media are constructing and here's another way of making sense of it, can that be transformative? I think it can be. I think it absolutely can be transformative.
I'm just, can you say a little bit more about the Amherst Cinema project? I know you were working with that. It sounds quite remarkable. Was it something that how was that developed?
The Amherst Cinema Project is, it's called See, Hear, Feel, Film. It was actually started...
See, Hear...
Feel, Film.
Feel, Film.
It was actually started in New York State at the Jacob Burns Center in, I believe it's Westchester, New York. And it's been brought to Amherst Cinema and tweaked a little bit for the local population. And it's a 5-unit program, 2 units of which the students, the third graders, come to Amherst Cinema. In the first visit to Amherst Cinema, they watch 2 short films, they're a minute long, animated films. And one of them is made by a little boy, actually, an 11-year-old boy. And what they practice, so immediately they get to see that, hey, somebody their age, close to their age, makes movies. This is not impossible, right? And the other film plays around with our perceived notions of what we hear and what we see, sort of challenges our visual, challenges our seeing, and challenges our hearing. And it's a little worm that looks like it lives in a country house, but in fact, once the camera, quote unquote camera, it's animated, pulls out, we see that the worm lives in an apple, and the apple is on the counter, and it's in a city. So it sort of plays around with, it's tricking the eye, right? It's to trick the eye. And the students then create poems and they make storyboards that help tell a story, right? The second unit where they come to the cinema is they watch 2 slightly longer films, one about a little girl who's moved out of the city. She lives in Denmark and she's moved out of Copenhagen into the country, and she's very angry about this because she misses her friends. And one is a little boy who is blind, and he's at a boarding school and in Iran, and his father is late to pick him up. And in the time that the boy is waiting for his dad, he helps rescue a baby bird that's about to be pounced on by a cat. And the students then they learn about conflict, and internal conflict, and what somebody might be thinking might be different from what they're saying. And then their projects from there is they do dialogue. So they have somebody speak what's in their head and then somebody say the words out loud. So they practice that. And it's across
Sounds
the board.
Wonderful.
Oh, it's phenomenal. And across the board, it's.
So your students come in and support that.
My students are the educational
effort.
Facilitators
Great.
For that. They do the group. They and a lot of folks from the Amherst community will work with the students as the group leaders to develop the dialogue, to work on the storyboards, the poems, etc.
That's exciting.
Yeah.
We have just a few minutes left. I want to go back just so you can tell us a little bit more, if people are interested, about the Mass Media Literacy Consortium and anything you want people to know. We just have a few minutes left.
Okay.
About that project.
The Massachusetts Media Literacy Consortium, that's, if you do a web search, you'll find our website. We're also on Facebook. It's free to join. Joining just says that you're supporting who we are. Certainly folks can get in touch with me at UMass if they want to learn more.
And what is your email, Allison?
At UMass, it's A-T, as in Thomas, Butler, B-U-T-L-E-R, com.umass.edu.
And people can also go to the Department of Communication website.
Yep.
And under faculty,
yep,
you'll find that
yep,
connection.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I mean, I'd love to talk with folks further, or anybody who wants to get involved, any teachers out there who want us to help them develop their media literacy curriculum, bring it on. We'd be happy to help. We're working hard to develop K-12 curriculum quite literally as we speak right now.
In your experience in New York City, you spent a number of years working in the New York City public high school, the reform schools under Bloomberg and mm-hmm. Klein, Joel Klein. I'm feeling a little sad and frustrated that the time is coming to a close. We only have about 2 minutes left and we didn't get into any of that at all. But examples that you can look at where teachers were working together to try to push back against the system, related to media literacy or just generally the neoliberal squeeze of testing. Did you see any of that in New York City, things that are heartening in that way of teachers locking arms, of there being solidarity? We saw it in the Chicago teachers' strike.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And it's Jean Anion, that's the educator that I was thinking about, who did speak about when we had her on the show several years ago.
Yeah.
And she spoke about examples she's been a part of.
Ghetto schooling, right? It was.
I'm not sure, but just of teachers coming together to develop forms of solidarity in the classroom and beyond. And I'm wondering if you can have any examples of that.
When I was in New York City, when I was working in the public schools in New York City, it was at the pretty beginning stages of Bloomberg's taking over of the school system, liquidating the large failing schools and replacing them with small schools, literally small schools, no more than 100 students per grade. So everybody was still sort of trying to figure out how that was going to play out when I was still there. And I think instead what I saw was teachers that were beyond 100% devoted to their classrooms and trying to make the space as safe and healthy and productive for their students as possible, and trying to make sure that their students were provided with opportunities to get beyond the labels that had been applied to them.
So the squeeze. We're going to have to put this on hold and have you back another time.
I will come back. I can talk about this for
days. From the two books Allison has written, and I've only really been able to go through one, which is Media Literacy Goes to School, published in 2010, and her most recent, Majoring in Change, 2012, which to some extent does follow the youth that she worked with in her effort to bring media literacy into one of those small school reforms. We'll have to save that for another
I will
time
come back.
Because
Absolutely.
There's just a tremendous depth and breadth of knowledge of how that neoliberal squeeze under Bloomberg played out. Yeah. And so I thank you for being here, for your advocacy and articulation around media literacy. There were so many other questions that I wanted. I've heard your wealth of knowledge in terms of just talking about popular culture, and I realized we could do a whole show, which would in some ways be more fun to have us just spin kind of what is going on now.
Oh yeah,
and that knowledge that young people bring into the classroom that you interact with. What does that all mean in terms of just of what's going on? What are the fireworks that are happening there that we need to kind of think about that's on TV or et cetera, and just spin that. So that'll
Great
be
fun.
Another show.
Great. Thank you so much for having me, Joel. I really
Thank
appreciate
you.
It.
Thank you, Allison Butler, professor in the Department of Communication at UMass, scholar of media studies. Allison Butler, thank you so much. I'm Joel Sachs. This is the Bread and Roses Show, and carry on the struggle in whatever way you may. Take care. Have a good day.